Hello and welcome back to the Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast. Joining me, Chris Worthington today, Jim Middleton. Hello, sir.
Hello, mate. Are you all right?
And this is a very special episode because I have two very special guests all the way from Australia. Richard Moss, returning guest, Richard Moss.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be back again.
And new guest, Connor O'Keen.
Hey guys, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
So for those who don't know, Richard and Connor are members of Creative VC who are in the process of releasing a five-part documentary called Terabytes, a history of horror video games. And we're going to be diving right into that immediately. So over to you guys. What I'd like to do here is kind of start at the end and end at the start. So because you know what people are like with attention spans. Let's imagine that some people listening to this will only listen to the first 3 minutes. So let's just launch in. Give us the skinny. What is Terabytes? Where can we find it? And how do we consume it? And then we'll get into a bit more detail.
Sure. Okay, so Terabytes, or the full title is Terabytes, The Evolution of Horror Gaming. It's a five-part documentary. Each episode is an hour, except the first one, which is an hour and a half. And each episode goes into a different, topic, exploring the world of horror in games. So you've got survival horror, you've got licensed games, you've got like FMV and connected stuff similar to that. You've got indies and you've got controversial games and taboo and fake games and just a general wrap up in the final episode. And you can get it from terabytesdoc.com. And that's, terror as in terror. It's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And bytes with a Y.
you look real high. Don't get confused. What we did there.
Yeah. Just to repeat that, it's terabytesdoc.com, isn't it? That's the website. Cool. So that's where you can find it. And we're going to be talking a lot more about what it is and how it's structured. The first two episodes are available now. That's correct, isn't it?
That is correct, in as finished a state as they possibly could be. They're subject to minor changes just in the final legal cut. But for the time being, they're as close to done as they can be.
Cool. And episodes 3 to 5 still on schedule for release this month?
We'll be squeezing in hopefully at the end of this month. Yeah. But again, pending the legal edits and stuff, it may be pushed out a week or so.
Fine. So there are thereabouts by the end of this month. That's great. Mm-hmm. So your collective background then and Creative VC's background, so a history of documentaries and video game documentaries, and obviously, Richard, we spoke to you about the wonderful history of football video games that you did with Bitmap Books. We talked to you in the autumn, I think, of last year. So
October it was.
Wow,
October,
the time flies. Yeah. So we've heard obviously about your personal background, but give us a quick history of the kind of the documentary side of what you do and what Creative VC do, and in particular, where did the idea of this idea of the evolution of horror video games come from?
Okay, yeah. So the really short explainer of Creative VC is they started about a decade ago or so. They did a thing called In Search of the Last Action Hero. Yeah. It was this super doc about 80s action films. And then they followed that up with what has since become their flagship franchise, In Search of Darkness, which is 4 hours. One single film going into 1980s horror movies. And that did well enough that they then have since made two more in the 1980s for a total of 13 or 14 hours of deep dive into the horror movie world. And now they're doing the 90s, and they're doing that in two parts, the first half of the 90s, the second half of the 90s. And meanwhile, they've also done a sci-fi doc and Aliens Expanded. They're working on The Thing Expanded. And I joined the company. I got a mysterious email about 4 years ago from the CEO, Robin Block, just kind of saying that they're starting up work on this documentary about first-person shooters, and he'd like to talk to me. And that's about all he told me. I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll hop on the call. And I'm
Were you and a I'm big thinking name in that, the FPS community at that point or something?
No. I'm reasonably well known as someone who does games history as well as journalism. And I found out on the call that the reason he was contacting me is he'd read a 8,000 word history of first person shooters I did for Ars Technica. Mm-hmm. And I had been thinking that maybe I'm just like being screened as a possible talking head expert or something. But pretty soon in, after he's felt out what I'm like, and he's decided, okay, this dude's all right, he's pitched me on writing the documentary.
Wow.
just out of the blue. And I'm like, huh? Okay, I don't know anything about you guys. I need to think about this.
You're reaching for your mace.
So I'm like, I look up the company, I look up In Search of Darkness, I say, okay, these guys are a pretty big deal in their little niche. And he sends me, they had actually a little proposal that had already been put together by some random guy who responded to an ad that they put online. And it turns out that they'd put the ad on just one of those freelance portals that like no one who is a proper professional looks at. It's only the small fry people. Yeah. And so the guy that they got, he's okay. He's actually a really nice guy. I met him, but he was in over his head. Yeah. And so my job was to rewrite the synopsis and then kind of take it from there. And we're feeling each other out at this point. And so I go away, I come up with this kind of wish list of what the perfect deep dive genre documentary about FPS games would be, not knowing anything about how to fit it into runtimes and stuff, and kind of not really worrying about that, just trying to hit their format, which is every game gets its own segment, and along the way you have some like discussion things.
Yeah,
I came up with the name Breakouts for them, but it's a theme discussion for a few minutes or a bit longer. Now we're going to be talking about engine technology and how it evolved, or we ended up doing one on the beginnings of the esports scene, because that's a big deal in the FPS world, or about modding. We had one on modding. So I came up with this whole massive synopsis, and I enjoyed it. So I met the editor. I kind of gradually became more involved. I officially joined the team. I brought in sort of internet friend of mine, David Craddock, who is a proper FPS expert.
Yeah.
He's like massive Doom fan. He's wrote a book called Rocket Jump about Quake. And he made me feel a bit less less insecure about the fact that I'm like going to be helming this thing. And I'm not sure what I'm doing.
I've got the knowledge on board now.
And David was just going to be sort of an advisor, maybe a producer. Mm. But then he kept turning up to all the meetings, not realizing he didn't need to. And he so impressed the editor and the CEO that he got with my okay, like I was asked, are you all right with this? He got the nod to become a co-writer and director on FPS. So he and I did that film together.
Yeah.
And then towards the end of that, coming to the end of this story now, we're almost finished with FPS. Robin Block has a mate, Daniel Richardson, who he was working with on another project. Yeah. I don't know much about this, but they knew each other. And Dan was like, how about you do In Search of Darkness, but for games?
Yeah.
And Robin wasn't sure. He's not that big a gamer. We only really did the FPS thing because he's a Halo guy. He loves Halo. And Dan had to convince him that there's an audience, that's an interesting idea. And once he got over that hurdle, then Dan came up with this massive proposal, came to me. Between us, we decided it should be episodic rather than a super doc.
Yeah.
And we whittled it down to this idea of a 5-part series from a good dozen plus ideas for what the episodes could be about. We went through this what was called a validation, where we just went online, hey, can you fill out this survey to see if people were interested and get some sense of what people would want in a documentary like this? And that did well enough that we decided to officially greenlight it. We went to a crowdfunding campaign that we call a pre-sale for various reasons. And then we made the thing, and Connor got hired a few months after we did that campaign to be our editor.
Cool. So what's your background, dude? Connor, then? How did you get involved with Terabytes?
Sure. I've never heard the whole Richard Moss story until now regarding, his involvement with Creative EC. So that was a thrill, man. I was glued to my seat.
You learn something in every one of these things you do, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's really cool, dude. I comparatively, the fact that you got, sought out and handpicked for that project, that's such a compliment. So cool. I feel like I comparatively snuck through the back door and just rocked up and was like, oh, can I have a job, please? No, I'm just a big fan of Creative EC and what they do, especially with the In Search of Darkness series. I had backed the trilogy when it got to the third part. I'd managed to see through friends and stuff over the years the first two movies, and I was like, I love this. Mm-hmm. This is wonderful. And I knew they were doing a third, so I was like, all right, I'm gonna hold out for that box set. Got the box set. I've got the posters on the wall behind me, and I'd had those up since I got the thing in the parcel in the mail. Not too long after that, I got an email just going out to backers, updating them on progress for In Search of Darkness 90s is coming up. Yeah. And also a little thing at the bottom of the email: we're currently looking for editors. Now, I work as I'm a independent filmmaker here in Melbourne, but I make a buck editing. And I was like, oh my God, that sounds like a dream job. So I applied. I got through the initial application process and got onto the next part of the process, which was a kind of audition edit using footage from In Search of Darkness. So even just putting this audition edit together, I was using footage of John Carpenter and Keith Davis, yeah, and just, giddy. And ended up getting to the last part of the last stage of the interview process, didn't quite get the job. But had really good feedback on my edit from Robin, again, the CEO, and was told to, keep in touch. I didn't keep in touch because, you figure that's just what people say. Yeah, who does?
Yeah.
They don't want to hear from little old me. anyway, by the end of – or the start of last year, start of 2024, the places that I'd had been freelancing at, one of them in particular went through a massive kind of restructure where they were the video production wing of a – larger advertising agency, and decided to strike out on their own. And they were like, don't worry, we're taking you with us and we'll have work for you. I was like, okay. And they didn't have work for me. So I'm looking for work and looking at all these ads that are just making my soul ache because they're all like, we want someone who lives and breathes social media. And I'm like, no, dear God, no.
Yeah.
And I was talking to my partner at the time and was kind of having a moan, and she said, oh man, what would a dream job for you be? And I said, this audition edit I got for Creative EC, a year ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. She said, oh man, what happened? I said, oh, they said to keep in touch. She was like, and did you? I was like, well, no, of course not. Why would I? And she was like, you should get in touch. So I shot them an email with my showreel up to that point. And got a response from Robin saying, hey, really appreciate your enthusiasm, but a showreel doesn't exactly show us that you can do what we would need you to do for our company, which is long-form docos and stuff. Do you have anything in that realm that would, help your case here? And I fortunately had one quite polished documentary form piece of work that I'd worked on the previous year and an 80-minute doco that I'd made about my own band to put as a bonus feature on our first album, like a DVD set. And that got me an interview got me a call with Richard and Daniel and Robin. And I don't know, I think we gelled really well in the first meeting, and I got the gig on the back of that. So that was really cool. But yeah, I've been shooting, writing and editing since I was 16. I'm now 32, so half my life at this point, and I feel like this is the the best thing I've ever had the privilege of working on. This feels like, yeah, dream project territory.
I definitely want to get into some of the process around, you know, the editing process.
And, how you
collapse it down. Is that what you were going to say, Jim, before?
It is. Because obviously I wondered whether you had, so you've got your edit. Do you edit that to knowing what licenses you've got, or does the licensing and everything else come afterwards? Where do you start, basically?
Well, Richard and Dan like laid the groundwork for this thing, like in terms of having the episodes and the themes and games that they were hoping to hit. Yeah. And Richard can talk way more about that. But in terms of when the editing starts, it starts with Richard sending through a script of one segment at a time. He'll send through scripts that are made up of the interview, you know, transcripts. Okay. Going like, all right, from this time code to this time code, this person, it's, you know, this chunk of dialogue from them, and then this chunk of dialogue from this person, and then this chunk of dialogue from this person. Mm-hmm. And you get a sense through the scripting that, oh, you like, this is the story he's trying to tell. You know, I've vibed with everything that he's sent my way. I felt like from the first thing he sent over, I was like, I get what he wants this to be. I think let's have a go. And it's been good. I think it's been a really good working relationship between me, Richard, and Dan working on these edits. I think we've gotten into a better and better flow as it's gone on.
Yeah, Richard, talk a little bit about that then. So I was. I really like these kind of documentaries when there's no overarching narrator kind of telling you what you're, you know, for people who haven't seen it, this documentary is essentially told to us by gameplay footage and interviews. There's no overarching narrative across
the There's top. A theme, isn't there? Like I said, there's a theme to each episode.
And we'll talk about kind of each and how those come out. But what I'm interested in from a kind of a starting point on this, Richard, you said you went out, you did some market research. Where do you start? I mean, we had this conversation about the football games book as well. I mean, you've basically got 40 years at this point of, because horror is not a genre in itself. Horror is a theme, right? Horror sits across all video game genres pretty much. So where do you start?
I mean, where I start is with Dan and his mountain of knowledge his concept. That was the starting point of it all, and just talking to him about what he thinks is most interesting in the horror space, and
from a video game perspective or just generally,
generally, but particularly video games. And he talks quite beautifully. It's one of the things that really struck me early on and drew me into this project is that the way he talks about horror games, which I've since come around to his view on this. It's that basically they're sort of this window into our humanity. They provide catharsis when we're struggling with things. They help us deal with our issues. It's not just about like giving you a jump scare or grossing you out with some body horror. That happens, of course. That's like the cheap kind of horror. That's very effective
part of the fun.
For a lot of people.
But, that's the fun bit.
Yeah.
But horror can be so much more than that. And that was what was really exciting to me, talking to him about what this could be, thinking about, well, the people who are making these kinds of games, that darkness is coming from somewhere. And we want to dig into that. We want to understand what are they trying to do here? Why are they, like Silent Hill is just really, really dark themes. They talk about abortion in that. They talk about incest. They talk about stuff that you do not talk about.
Yeah.
And they do it through like these video game metaphors. And that's really interesting to think about. And so that I thought more and more about, well, I want to look at the human side of these games. What goes into making them? What are they about? How do they move people? And particularly the people who make them, but also some of the experts on the genre that we've interviewed to provide that narrative glue along the way in the bigger picture context. I want to really look at that human side. And so this was my starting point. It was going from Dan to there and then thinking about his ideas for what the episodes could be and kind of fleshing those out.
Sorry to interrupt there. Did you have the five, did you have the ideas of the themes of each episode? Was that an early thing or did that come later once you started to amass the content?
That was part of Dan's original pitch.
Original, was it?
Yeah, not the very, very first pitch. The very first pitch was broader than that. But once we decided it was episodic, he went away and he wrote a proposal for, I remember it being about a dozen. It could have been more. It could have been slightly less. But a lot of episode ideas. And then we kind of went back and forth a bit and we talked about what was most interesting there or what was most like underdone in the media space, what doesn't get the attention it deserves and should have a spotlight shone on it. Like we've got episode 3 is primarily about full motion video games, which are always the butt of people's jokes. But there's a lot of really interesting ideas that went into that. And if you talk to the people who made them, they actually thought this is the future. This is what's going to happen. Yeah. Hollywood and games are going to merge together. This is this is the future of entertainment. They believed it with every fiber of their being. And it's funny in a way to think about that when you look at the games and how hammy and just ridiculous they are. But that's because they didn't know what they were doing. They were trying to figure out how to do interactive movies as they were going. Most of them didn't have a film background. They're game developers trying to make movies that you can play.
But there's no budget.
And it turns out there's ranging from no budget to like beauty.
Ranging from no budget to, you know, exceptional budgets in the case of like Phantasmagoria being, you know, the most expensive video games they'd ever put out.
I mean, the CD-ROM was such a huge thing, wasn't it, in the early 90s, this idea that you had all of this space to fill up, you know, you could do all of this thing. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to that one because I'm a big fan from a nostalgia point of view of some of those hammy efforts.
Totally.
Yeah, like they're hilarious, but also really endearing. And when you watch it, you'll see how much of themselves they put into it and how much it meant to them to be making these. And I love that we've got this actually in that episode, a really strong narrative where you're going through the rise of the genre. These games are becoming bestsellers and then it all just kind of collapses. And then years later, it comes back in a new form.
Exactly that. Yeah.
So we've got this really beautiful arc. Like
Yeah, and Sam Barlow's games as well, of course. I mean, they're FME, aren't they? And he's one of your contributors, which is great to see. He's a very interesting guy, I find,
I loved interviewing him. It was so interesting. I was really upset that I didn't have more time with him. That was actually an interview that we had like a really set limit because we were to save budget. We did 7 interviews at GDC last year. And so we had asked these people to just come to like this room that's across the street and hop on a call with us. We had a camera guy that we'd paid to go to this place and film them. And we had only a certain window and then we had to get the next person in. And so I was like really upset that I can't talk to him for 2.5-3 hours. We only had 90 minutes. And I'm like, I want to ask you more. You've got so much here. I really want to ask you about more stuff because he clearly had a lot more that we could discuss. But I had to focus mostly on the stuff he'd worked on. And along the way, we get some great nuggets, like him talking about the Thief games and the horror in Thief.
That was brilliant.
And him talking about Silent Hill and beyond just the one he worked on. He was a writer on and designer on Shattered Memories. But so him talking about these things and him talking about like a couple of Amstrad games that he played as a kid. I loved getting these stories from him. And I knew that there was a lot more that I could pull out if I just had time to start quizzing him on games that he'd played.
How are people generally, you know, contributors when you approach them about what you're doing and you invite them to come on and talk? What kind of responses are people generally positive and open to it?
Is that
you and Daniel that are reaching out to all these people as well, or is there?
It's us.
Yeah, do you have
it's
a
quite
team?
A small team. Quite a small team though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's so the team, the core team is three people. It's me, Dan, and Connor. And as you've heard, Connor didn't join until later, after we pretty much were almost done with all the interviews at that point. So basically it was me and Dan making the thing. We had help from an associate producer who works across a bunch of different projects at Creative AC. His name's Dominic. He's great. He was setting up the logistics for the interviews on in terms of where and when they're happening. So Dan was liaising with the contributor to find out when they're available. Dan and I, between us, would make the initial contact, one or the other, would actually get the person to agree. But once we had them confirmed, Dan, as producer, would take things out of my hands, which is great. I didn't have to worry about that. He'd find out when they're available. And then he would work with Dom to figure out the where and when it's going to happen. And so between the three of us, we'd get it all sorted. I'd write these big, long question sheets. And if I could make it, I would run the interview. Sure. And usually one or both of them would be there with me. And if one of us drops off, then the others can take over. Sometimes I would let them just jump in with a question off the cuff. Because I'm focused on this massive sheet and trying to run an interview. You know how hard it is running an interview. What am I going to ask them next? You're always thinking, what's the next question going to be? But these guys, they're just listening. They can enjoy the interview. And so they can go, oh, it'd be really cool if we asked them about this. And I'm like, come in, ask that.
Because you're under time pressure, right? You know, when you know you've got Sam Barlow for 90 minutes and you've got this long list of questions that you want to get through, I mean, you must be so conscious of, come on, Sam, that's enough about the Amstrad now. I need to ask you about this.
Yeah. And sometimes I'd be interviewing someone, I'm like, we're not going to have time to get through all this, okay. So I'm scrolling up and down as I'm listening to it. I'm trying to think what's the next question, but also thinking ahead.
Yeah.
What do I skip over later? What am I going to get rid of here? What, based on what they've been telling me so far, what's
hard.
Least
really
likely to get an interesting answer?
Yeah. Do you feel like, I'm curious myself, actually, do you feel like are there any contributors where that time limit, like there were things that you feel in the process of putting the scripts together you were left without? Things that you're like, if I should have asked this question instead of this one, like...
Yes. I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head.
Sure.
Absolutely, yes. I remember maybe four or five times during scripting, I was like, damn, I really would have liked to have asked them about this. Or if it's an interview that Dan did and I wasn't able to make it. I wish Dan had asked this. And that's really tough because Dan doesn't have a background in journalism. I trained him briefly. Like he sat in on three interviews with me and I spent an hour telling him everything I could in that hour about how to do a good interview. And so three interviews shadowing me, an hour of just picking my brain about it. And then he had to do one on his own.
Did you, were there many... like real kind of like holy cow moments, to give you a couple of examples from what I've seen, you know, the Jeremy Blaustein moment in episode one was pretty incredible from a viewing perspective. And also I've just seen on your socials, although this isn't released yet, but I think it was a clip from what I assume is episode three, where you had the creator of The Seventh Guest talking
Graham
about
Devine.
Some of the struggles around the 11th Hour was the sequel, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, how does that feel when you're in an interview process and you think, wow, this is amazing?
Yeah. The secret of getting those moments is usually that you do really good research. I research as much as I can on every contributor, and I find what are the things that I can pick at. And sometimes there's a little hint of the story already there. They will have mentioned something at some point, maybe. Other times, there's just a sense, if you're looking at what they've said before, that there's more beneath the surface, that they're not telling the whole story. And when either of those things happen, there's that thread that I can pull at. And I try my best to come up with some questions to set that up. And then hopefully I'm running the interview and I can go on my instincts and experience to figure out on the fly how and when to push them.
Yeah, and how far.
Because it's a very delicate thing.
Yeah.
Because we've got interviews in here where people are talking about grief. Like they've lost loved ones and they've then gone and made a game to process that, or they have had like their world changed by that and they're reframing everything in their life based on that experience and what's happened. In the case of Graham Devine, I don't want to give too much away, but it had a huge toll on him physically, mentally, emotionally, working on those games. He was putting everything in. They were crunching for basically years on those games at Trilobite. And on top of that, he had the stress of his company. After they did The Seventh Guest, they got lots of money. And this was a shock to them because they'd left Virgin to make this game, but they're just a small team there and no one's going to expect that on your first game as a new company, you're going to hit it big.
Yeah.
So they had millions of dollars and they're like, how do we spend this money? And they both had ideas. And so they're pulling in different directions, how they want to proceed. And Graham's like, we should just basically do The Seventh Guest again, use the technology, make a new thing, new story using the same technology while we're also maybe working on some new, completely different idea. But then his business partner, Rob, wanted to go really ambitious. He wanted to get closer to making an actual movie. And they were pulling in different directions. And eventually, as they're doing this, and they each have multiple projects, it kind of gets to breaking point. And neither of them's paying enough attention. The company gets really really messy in its operations, and then we had to compress this story for runtime in the episode, but eventually the board fired Rob, and it was right after Graham had said he's going to quit. Because Graham's the tech guy. They need Graham. he's the genius who made the technology. So he said, I'm leaving, I can't do this anymore. They said, no, you're not quitting. Rob's quitting.
Yeah, damn it. Wow.
You're going to stay.
Victims of their own success, right?
Yeah. And stuff like that must be difficult to talk about as well.
Yeah, because they're not talking to a family member or a best friend. They're talking to, you know, with respect for Richard, you're a disarming guy and you're very, very good at what you do, but you don't know this guy. It's not like you've known him for years. He's not going to, no one's going to put their heart and soul out to, you know, someone who they don't know until they do.
Yeah, and that's one of the things you learn as a journalist is with the right questions and like a good bit of empathy, you can get people to just open up their hearts and it all comes pouring out. They'll tell you deep, dark secrets about themselves that they haven't even told their loved ones sometimes because you're a stranger and you're just an ear that they can that they can let this all out on. In Graham's case, I did know him. We're not buddies or anything, but he wrote the foreword for my Mac gaming book. So I'd talked to him before. We had a bit of a rapport and he's just a really nice guy. And
he comes across that way for sure in the interviews I've read.
And I went for it bit by bit. I just kind of eased him into doing it. And that's how I always do it. I try to get people as comfortable as I can first. Yeah. Ask them the easy questions, get them really relaxed. And then when it feels like the moment is right, when I can sense that they're ready, then comes the question that's going to get the tears, that big emotional moment.
Yeah, and not just tears out of the guests either. He's gotten some really excellent stuff out of these contributors, to the point where I have been in tears while putting some of these edits
I'm
together.
I'm not surprised.
I was gonna ask you that, Connor. Do you feel like a certain weight of responsibility when you're putting this footage together?
Yeah, absolutely.
And just while you're answering that one, Connor, talk a little bit about your process there, about kind of how, you know, you've obviously got all this amazing content which comes over from Richard. One of the couple of reviews that I was reading on the first couple of episodes, universally praising the visual look and feel of the show.
Oh.
And, you know, certainly from my experience, it all just hangs together so well.
Oh, thanks so much.
From a presentation point of view, what's your process like in terms of turning that all of that amazing content into what we see?
Sure. Oh, well, first of all, thank you so much. I appreciate that so greatly, and the all of the feedback that's drawn attention to the edit has been, you know, just really moving, especially again after I before we started recording, I kind of alluded to, like, hey, we've been working on this. I mean, I've been working on this for 9 months, Richard even longer. Like, we're happy to be able to talk about this stuff. Once I've put an assembly edit just based off Richard's scripts together, again, I feel like I know what this needs to be to make Dan and Richard happy, and I know what I want this to be to make me happy. I think that's been a really big part of this whole experience of working on Terabytes. It's been a massive learning experience. Again, I've been doing it long enough to feel confident that I've put myself in a position where I was a good pick for the job, and I was proud of that. But I've never worked on something this, lofty in ambitions before, and especially not something that's so close to home for me. I love horror and I love video games. And so I've, you know, every other week I'm battling bouts of imposter syndrome, because I'm thinking, like, I'm scared I'm not going to do a good enough job. I'm scared I'm not going to do this material and the work that Dan and Richard have put in before I rocked up justice, you know? But once I kind of get through that, those waves of self-loathing, I get on with it. And then I have real good fun going through the edit as it is after the paper edit's put together, and going, like, okay, I love this, like, as a viewer and as a lover of this kind of content and this the genre and the medium, I love this. This bit's losing me. Why is this bit losing me? It's usually something to do with context, which can be helped by B-roll, but sometimes it's, I want to hear this earlier. If I heard this earlier in the piece, then hearing this bit here would move me damn near to tears. And I try it, and usually it just feels good. It makes my heart sore. So I'm like, all right, that's a good sign. I'm going to go out on a limb here and hope that this is, you know, good for Richard and Daniel as well. And I think every time it's been good. It's been received really well, and that's been really encouraging. And then I've just kind of gotten on a roll to the point now where I feel pretty confident changing things where I feel like it just could be even cooler. It's never coming from a place of, like, this stinks, here's how I do it. It's like, this rules, I love this, and I love this even more. So, you know, have at it. And then, yeah, taking B-roll from the video games that these people are talking about, from that's been sourced by, again, Daniel, Richard, like, their work didn't stop when it came to the edit time. They've been busting their asses, pardon my French, you know, behind the scenes to get this thing over the line as well when it comes to the edit. So I get gameplay capture from them and Dom as well, and I go through all of it. I watch every bit of it to just get a sense of what I'm working with, the raw materials that I'm working with. And then try and find stuff that creates a little bit of a conversation between the interviewees and the B-roll, so that doesn't just feel like, oh, it's gameplay footage of that game they're talking about. It's providing context for people who might not have any. Like, I would love for this to be a documentary that people who are steeped in the genre are moved by and feel, vindicated in their love of this thing, that they can point to it and go, see, this is why I love this stuff. And that people who don't have any love for it or don't have any, you know, understanding of it can watch it and understand why someone could be moved by this stuff. Mm. And so that's kind of what I'm aiming to make each segment do. And then, again, having a good, a fairly solid grasp of what the narrative of the whole thing should be doing, making sure that, all right, this flows well. You know, there's no points where the momentum is kind of dying off, or no parts that feel, you know, paced poorly. I've again, been doing this long enough that I had a vague understanding of pacing previous to working on this, but this whole project has helped my grasp of that immensely.
He's really grown on that.
What's that, sorry?
Connor's really grown on the pacing front over the course of this thing. Like early edits, he would like make good improvements to the story in terms of the order of things. If what had been written on paper in that paper edit, in the document I gave him, didn't really work that well once you had it on the screen, you'd get that. But then some of the pacing wouldn't be right. Clips would kind of be on top of each other.
Yeah.
And the secret to doing really good storytelling is that sometimes you got to let things breathe more. You got to have that pause there, breath. You got to actually hear a breath. You don't want to cut out every breath sometimes.
Totally. That,
you know, I sort of helped him with comments.
You put me back in touch with feedback. Yeah, you put me back in touch with good instincts that I'd developed over the years that I'd kind of had to shirk in favor of, like, again, making a buck and working on very, what do you call it? What's the word? Corporate material, and material that is fairly loveless, you know, from the people, you know, making the thing and like hands down to me. Soulless, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they don't care about pacing. They do not care about, like, this moment, even if it's supposed to be like, Jesus, the buzzword of like, we want this to be like an emotive, powerful ad for a vacuum cleaner. Like, they'll use those two words so much it makes me want to puke. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like a power drill ad that they're like, this is the most emotive, powerful power drill ad, you know, on planet Earth. And I'm like, brother,
it's a power drill.
It's a power drill. I'm sure it's great, but it's not uniting families. You know, it's probably doing quite the opposite. But I had to kind of relearn, like, what do I, like, we're telling a story here. This isn't just a product. And you know that, and you wouldn't want it to be that. So make it what you would love to see. And I would love to see the story of this genre and this medium told in as official and as heartfelt and loving a way as possible. And Richard alluded earlier to talking about like the narrative for this thing. Even though they are, you know, separate episodes and covering separate aspects of horror gaming across each one, I think overall the series creates a kind of top-down view of like the timeline of horror in video games. And we are in a really privileged and wonderful position to be able to try and capture this moment in time where, you know, gaming as a video games as a medium and horror as and as a vehicle for horror in that medium is still in its relative infancy, compared to other genres, mediums. But it's been around long enough for there to be a real legacy and some really culturally significant, entries and contributions that have been made. And so many of those people, the old guard, are still around and still
around.
Keen to talk about this stuff, the same way that we're keen to talk about this doco we've been working on, like passionate, still creative people. As well. Exactly. And we've got the new wave of people who are making games that were, you know, so deeply inspired by those earlier games. And again, creating that conversation between the old guard and the new and the art that they made. It's, I don't know, it's really exciting. And again, I think we have created a kind of top-down view and a snapshot of this moment in time.
Yeah.
And you get a sense of just how far deep running the tendrils of horror in video games kind of are. Yeah.
You know, I'm really glad you said that about kind of the new guard reflecting on work that the old guard had done.
Mm.
You'll have to remind me of her name, but she worked as a writer on The Walking Dead, the
Mary Kenny.
Season.
Yes. Oh, yes.
She was, and it was really fascinating when she was talking, she was reflecting back on the earlier seasons of Walking Dead in episode 2, and then she obviously introduces her own piece then as a writer on, and she got quite emotional, didn't she, in the interview? You could hear her voice starting to break, you know,
yep,
I was thinking, that's so cool talking about, you know, because everyone who's in the industry now were fans. You know, Connor, you've just said yourself, you know, how you got involved with the company. It was so cool to hear her almost kind of reflecting on the work that inspired her and then reflect at the same time on her own work. It again created a really powerful visual moment.
Mm. Yeah, totally. And I think it all reinforces the just how cyclical creativity and art is. And I love that because I imagine this thing eventually, you know, sitting on the shelf of future horror gaming creatives or creatives of any stripe. Like, you know, hopefully this thing inspires someone to have a crack at whatever it is they love doing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So have you guys, obviously we've got five episodes in the series. Mm-hmm. Just to recap, so episode one, survival horror. Episode two, licensed horror games, there or thereabouts, or licensed influence adjacent, isn't it?
Yeah, homages, all that sort of stuff.
Homages, yeah, things like Dead by Daylight, which then had the licensed updates and stuff like that comes in, doesn't it, as well? Then we've got the FMV slash narrative episode in episode three, episode four, indie, and then episode five, lots of Night Trap, controversial games, and a bit of a wrap-up. You guys, I mean, this is probably asking you what's your favourite child, but have you got, is there a favourite episode, Richard, of yours, or one that you're most keen for people to see?
For me, there are two I love the most. I mean, they're all, I like them all.
They're all great.
I should clarify, you know, it's just like, that. Actually, before I answer you, I asked a few developers about, like, what's your favourite whatever that you've worked on, favorite game in the series, favorite game you've done, and it's always hilarious because they go, how can you ask that? It's like asking me which one is my favorite child.
That's why it's fun to ask, right?
And now that you've got two kids, but, you know exactly how that feels.
I said to someone yesterday, someone asked me a question, and I said it's like that, and I said, it's a very difficult but not impossible question to answer, what's your favorite child? So, again, it's a fun question to ask.
So anyway, now to actually answer you, I have a sentimental favorite, which is episode three. I'm an adventure game fan. I love every single game covered in that episode. I love. So it's a sentimental favorite because it's got all my favorite things in it. And I've been able to tell this story of a genre that I adore and that I think doesn't get the love that it deserves, that you know, it shouldn't be mocked the way it is. Yes, it's hammy and there are some bad designs in there, but there's a lot of love and skill and care and craft going into them.
Well.
And then episode four, as a writer, it's my favorite. I think I did a really good job weaving together lots of themes in there and exploring this creative space and some of the really quite deep and dark things that being indie, these people can explore.
There's some segments in there that are beautiful. Without giving anything away, on episode four, how far back do you go in terms of looking at the indie space?
Yeah, I was really tempted to go back like all the way because there's indies in the 80s, there's indies in the 90s. We didn't call them that, but they were. In the end, I decided that the best thing to do here is a more focused story. We're going to talk about the modern indie scene and the creativity in that. So right in the first segment, we've got John Romero, one of the old school indies, because id Software, they were indie at the beginning of their life. They were putting things out as shareware. We've got him talking about what indies can achieve, how indies can, like, but just a few people, they can change the world. And then Minecraft, he brings up, like, I didn't prompt him on this. He mentioned Minecraft comes out 2009, which is about the time that the indie explosion happened. Yeah. And that turned into this massive thing that got sold to Microsoft for billions of dollars. And what indie doesn't see something like that and get inspired to then like go and make their own games. So it was the perfect way of saying, okay, we're just going to focus on this scene. It's one of those lucky things where I didn't really prompt him to do it. I just asked him a few questions and he gave me the perfect answer.
Yeah, some kind of structure kind of falls into your lap there. It's very nice.
Yeah, it's quite nice, yeah. Yeah, it gives you a whole theme.
Totally.
Yeah, and what about you, Connor? Have you got a favourite of the five?
I think I'm going to follow in Richard's footsteps here and kind of justify two. I think the first episode is probably my the one I at this point in time feel the most proud of. There are a couple of moments in there that you alluded to earlier, the Silent Hill 2 segment in particular.
It's incredible.
I'm really happy with that. Like that was a moment.
I was asking him, can you stretch out this? Find an extra frame here. I want to hold on this moment just a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And then that bit, totally. Just hold and a little bit longer. We want to follow in this sadness.
Totally. I felt like I'm not a Trekkie, but I she won't hold Captain sort of stuff. Cause I'd already stretched those moments out to like as far as I thought they could, like to breaking point. He was like, if we can get like 4 more frames on this, like I would love that. I'm like, all right, let's see. Ah, oh, it works. And like, yeah, I don't know, that was a segment that I was the most nervous about. I think that segment more than any other in the entire series, although there have been others that have kind of made me go like, all right, like I've got to G myself up to tackle this one, like to approach the blank sequence in Premiere Pro for this one. But yeah, that one I'm really pleased with. Everyone I've shown it to, I've shown it to friends, I've shown all of these episodes to my partner as we've been working on them. She's a gamer herself and wants to has studied game design and narrative within gaming and stuff. So she's just the target audience for this. And like those moments have been like, can we pause for a second and like have a bit of a cry sort of things. So it was like, yes, dude, this is great. So that episode,
sad, are they like just Richard? I know Richard was being was making a joke there, but I didn't. It's powerful. It's not sad as so much, and I think that's where the difference between having a really powerful human interest story around the game, and especially when then I think you then cut to the letter being read at the end of the game.
Yeah.
It really did create a massively powerful moment, but I didn't feel sad. After,
no,
it was just more like, wow.
I watch it and like, I'm moved by that moment because I think it's beautiful. Like, I sound excited talking about this stuff, but it's not out of some perverse, like, oh, look, he's crying, some sick, bent. It's or like a voyeuristic kind of angle. It's so achingly, it's beautifully human
feeling,
and like, I think so what I get out of so many of the stories shared in this documentary, be it from a creative, kind of standpoint or just a humanistic one, is that like I have gone through things that are discussed in this documentary in my own way, be it grief or loss or self-loathing or imposter syndrome and all those things. And those are things that people are dealing with on the daily, as humans and as creatives, and they're all discussed in this documentary in some way. And I get like immense, solace out of these stories because I go, I've been there, I've felt that, and now I don't feel so alone in that experience. I don't feel crazy or, oh God, I'm probably going to experience that at some point. There are people talking about fears here that I go, I haven't felt that yet, but I know I'm going to end up feeling that someday. And I'm going to have this to look back on. I'm going to have this thing to watch and feel some sense of like, oh, I'm not alone in this. Yeah. That's the most special thing on the planet.
That's cool.
But anyway, to finish your question, so episode one, I love.
So and,
episode four, I think four. All everything Richard said about like the way it's paced, the way it's put together, I'm really, really stoked with that one. Like Richard did a fantastic job just scripting and I just got to like elevate it. And I think we did a really great job with that material. And it also, I think that one holds the most games that I came away from working on footage of and going like, oh, I need to play that. I think that yielded the most, new Steam library additions, I think.
Yeah. I've been there over the last couple of days.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. When you're working on the episodes, like, together as a team, are you just focused on one at a time or are you sort of bouncing between episodes? Or
initially, we started with episode three, funnily enough, and I think that was a great one to start with because it's the most kind of what would you say, Richard? It's a bit out of left field. Like, it's not the first thing I thought we'd be working on. But it ends up being one of the most interesting ones because of that. And I think, like Richard alluded to earlier, by the end of the episode, you're really endeared to these people and their stories and their art. Totally makes you reassess your assumptions about them.
One of the things that I was reflecting on watching, particularly episode one, was just how not only does this serve as a history of the evolution of horror games, but it's actually the evolution of gaming generally. Because so many of the biggest titles, you know, you think of Resident Evil, Silent Hill, The Last of Us, Bloodborne. You know, these are some of the most critically revered games of all time. And they just happen to be horror themed. Maybe that says something about us as gamers and about as humans. I've got to ask, of course, you know, of all the games covered, Richard, first, what would you say was your favourite here? Do you have one? Or maybe one which, going into the project, maybe you hadn't really kind of, you hadn't played or you hadn't really felt that fondly. Did you come out the other end with a kind of newfound appreciation for any particular game?
Can I just jump in and also ask you that if so, obviously you're capturing the footage for these games. To go with Chris's question, is there one where you sat down and thought, I'll just play, you know, a couple of hours just to capture a bit of footage, and then you've just sat and played through the whole thing?
Deadly Premonition is the correct answer to as well, by the way.
Yeah.
I just watched the sheriff doing calisthenics for an hour.
I love Deadly Premonition, but it was actually Dom, the associate producer, Dom, who got the Deadly Premonition footage for us. So I didn't have to fight against the technical problems of running that game, because it's a really clunky, messed up thing. I adored going through that game back in the day, just not for the horror. I don't like the horror parts of it, really. I like the rest of it, all the world stuff, building and characters, and that's what's great about Deadly Premonition. We even have a couple of contributors talking about that in the segment. But so to answer your question, I didn't really mean to play through all of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. I was going to skip over some parts as much as I could. But I just sort of, I ended up playing the whole thing, and I got a little bit of extra footage that was helpful for Connor out of that. I really only needed to play two characters, but I played all of them and got lots of footage there. I played more of Night Trap than I think I needed to. I didn't quite finish it, but I played further than I needed to. The Seventh Guest, I'd never finished it before until this. So that was cool, and there was some footage there again that ended up being useful for Connor. Until Dawn is another one that I played through the whole thing. I couldn't stop. How can you stop playing that? You're playing this really long interactive movie. It's done so well, and I'm like, I've got to get to the end of this. I got to see what my ending is going to end up being here. And then I finish it and I'm like, I think I should play it again. No, I don't really have time to play it again.
Keep more alive.
Bad ending.
Because there are decisions I made because I knew that would make better footage. Like, this is going to do better for Connor in the edit, not how I want to play. This character, I think I should play them a different way to how I would play them, because that's going to be better when we do the thing. That's going to fit better with my script.
That's so funny.
What's going to happen here? There's this game, What Remains of Edith Finch, a beautiful indie game that I have owned a copy for years, and I had never gotten around to playing it. It wasn't even going to be in the indie episode actually originally, but a couple of our contributors talked about it. And what they said I thought was really beautiful. And I'm like, we got to fit this in. And it was perfectly aligned with some other comments that people made. So it went into this like discussion segment about desolation, social isolation, powerlessness. And for anyone who doesn't know that game, it's about a girl revisiting her family home and there's a myth within the family that they're cursed. The whole family is cursed. Everybody has died some weird or gruesome way. And she's going through the house, this really strange house, and like finding diaries and remembering her childhood and telling you the stories of how everybody died. And it's such a beautiful, achingly beautiful and haunting game. I didn't need to play all of that, but I could not stop. I played the whole thing, and I actually played it twice because the first time there was an issue with the footage.
Is there a bit of self-sabotage at play? I see your game.
No, it turned out that something had gone wrong with the capture, and I was watching it back, and I was this seems a bit weird and low res. What's going on here? Something had happened. I don't know what it was, but so I went back in and I played it again.
Clive Barker's Jericho.
Yeah, there are far worse games that could have happened to. That's really cool. That's one of my favorite segments. That one that you're alluding to with What Remains of Edith Finch, and that was one of the games that I went like, oh my god, adding that straight to the wish list. Jimbo,
excited to see that. Yep. Yeah, what about you, Connor? Any were there any games that you kind of played through that you didn't expect to enjoy, or that you don't like that you've now got a newfound appreciation for?
Absolutely. Just real quick, it dawned on me that I don't think I answered your question properly before, Jimbo. So we started with the third episode. You asked if we're bouncing between a lot of different episodes at once. We started with the third, then the second, then the first, fourth, and fifth. As we've kind of started working on the next one, there's been more. It's like I've been pinballing, between these five episodes more and more as they've kind of gone on, to the point now where I'm finishing episode five, but I'm also working on final touches for all of the other episodes at the same time and trailer stuff. So like we're all kind of, you know, it's the last leg of a marathon really, and it's uphill, baby. as for games, kind of going into this one, there were little things that I was surprised to be vindicated in terms of my experience with horror games. One of them being Max Payne is one of my favorite games, but that game I played when I was like 12 or 13 and it scared the hell out of me. Mm. The like nightmare sequence with the baby dying and stuff. Yeah. Oh my God. I felt so shook by that game that I felt the need to confess to my dad that I'd played something that had kind of warped my mind almost, because yeah, he was always like, he never stopped me from playing violent video games, but he'd always be like, you got to watch yourself, dude. Like what you put in there, it goes in there and it doesn't just come out. Like it sits in there. Be careful. And I was like, yeah, whatever, old man, daddy. You don't know about video games. And then I played Max Payne and it was just like, dad, I played
and scary the baby's crying.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a segment in the first episode talking about sound design or horror within games that aren't necessarily in the horror genre. And that gets a mention. And I felt hugely vindicated there. A game that I thought that had been spoiled for me just through like osmosis, just through being around horror video games over the years. When it came out, I was a bit too young to play it, Silent Hill 2. And so I never did play it. But over the years, I had the story kind of spoiled for me through just, you know, it gets brought up in essays and video essays and reviews and everything. And I kind of thought like, oh, well, the impact of that story will have... It's not going to have any effect on me because I know what's coming. But through editing that segment, I was so moved by all of it. And I kind of, and the way that the people spoke about, the contributors spoke about this game made me realize that that game is a Rorschach painting. You get what you bring to that game. And so I don't have a PS2 that I can, or a PS2 copy that I can use. I don't want to be futzing around with emulators, so I grabbed the Silent Hill 2 remake recently as a way to just at least experience the story, which by all accounts the story is like quite faithfully recreated in the remake. So I've really been enjoying that on the back of this doco, and I don't think I would have sought that out had I not been involved in this project. So that's a really cool, like, you know, forming new memories and relationships with that art.
Great stuff. Well, guys, thank you so much for giving up your Sunday, late Sunday evening as it is now in Australia. Jim, before we invite the guys just to kind of tell our listeners where and how you can get hold of Terabyte, any other questions from you?
Just one. VR, I feel like that's an area that is just where horror games in general just excel. And it feels like a natural evolution of the FMV stuff. Was there any temptation to sort of cover those in like an individual episode or anything like that?
We didn't feel it was the most compelling thing to look at. It's still a quite a new space. It's still developing.
But
we absolutely wanted to talk about VR, and so that's why it's mentioned in most of the episodes that there are some VR games covered in here. And get to episode 5, you'll see contributors talking about, well, where are things going in the future at the end of the episode?
Yeah.
And, of course, one of the things that comes up is VR. And so, yeah, there's going to be more VR stuff. We've got some cool VR stories in here. I loved Brian Gomez talking about Jurassic World Aftermath and like cartoon velociraptors. He's got a great story there. Just actually all of Brian's stories are brilliant, but that one I really enjoyed. VR totally is going to be a big part of the future of horror, but exactly how depends on how niche VR remains. Like, is it going to become properly mainstream at some point? Or is it going to always be a niche, in which case it'll always just be weird, tiny experimental things happening in VR, which will be great for people who love that kind of stuff, because those tiny, weird experimental things are always the most interesting.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Definitely. It kind of it serves, I think this doco ends up being ultimately a celebration of the genre and the medium's past, present, and future. And the VR part of that is kind of like where the things could go, which is really exciting. I know you said we're wrapping up, and I know this is highly unorthodox, but real quick before we do wrap up, I'd love to flip it back on you guys. You've watched the first two episodes. This is the first interview that I've been in where the people interviewing us have watched the actual full episodes and not just the trailer, and they're not just excited about the trailer. What, like, you're not going like, I hope to see this in this thing. You've seen what's in it. What do you've dug it by the sounds of it? Like, what do you like about it? Like, sell me on this thing, man.
Jim, do you want to go first?
Yeah, kind of. Again, so I'm a fan of the genre, but there was games in there. I have no mouth and must scream. Totally missed me by. So
no
same as you,
way.
Connor. It's missed me by. I never had the PC, did I, growing up?
No, it's true.
I wasn't a PC gamer. So I almost came in with Resident Evil and followed it from there. So, yeah, like the same as you, Connor, I've just been making notes of all these titles as I've gone along.
Very nice. Yeah. How about yourself, Chris?
I think for me, it's I'm such a sucker for these things. You know, the only thing I love more than I think actually playing video games is listening to people who really like them talk about them. What I'm not massively keen on though is there's a lot of documentaries and essays available on YouTube. A lot of them.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes if you were to say to me kind of what makes a great video game documentary, I'm not really articulate enough to say what it is. I mean, I can say the obvious thing, it's got to be well researched, it's got to be well presented, you know, it's got to be thorough enough, but not boring. I think what I always say to people is just have a look on YouTube if you want to see things which just don't feel right. You know, and Richard, I was really, really interested hearing you talk about that kind of leaving things room to breathe. How many, I mean, we all watch things on YouTube, right? How many things, like, you know, you watch 10 minutes of a thing on YouTube, which is, you know, a lot of it is hobbyist stuff, so I'm not criticizing anyone, but you feel overwhelmed by the stuff, whether it be visuals or sound. Like, it's just so much in, you know, whereas I think a professional video game documentary is, it feels informative, but it also feels like there's space in there for you to kind of reflect on what you've just watched. And what I particularly enjoyed about it is, I mean, for me, and my own personal experience, it's basically a love letter to everything that I've enjoyed over the past 35 years. I mean, seeing things like, you know, the footage from Sweet Home, the, you know, in the survival horror episode, you know, then just slowly but surely taking it through over the years, right through to last year's Crow Country, was a really nice touch, because it almost feels like, you know, it kind of shows how the whole thing is coming back full circle on itself now, and with the indie space has given us the experiences that we had 30 years ago. So, you know, it absolutely flies by. I mean, that first episode, an hour and a half, it absolutely zoomed by, to the point where when the second episode finished after an hour, I was like, oh, that was short. I want a bit more of that. I think it's a great piece of work, guys. And, you know, I think for anybody who is a fan of, I wouldn't just say horror games, actually. I would say really any gaming fan, unless you have an aversion to horror games, which obviously some people have, it is definitely something that I would recommend picking up. And you know, one of the things I really like about it, and this is a really small thing, you know, when like you're kind of moving from game to game and you have that kind of zoomed out, it's almost like a kind of virtual shelf.
Yeah, the wall.
All of box art, we call it.
Yes. I love that. Yeah. And then it kind of zooms in and you're like, oh, is it going to go to Dead Space? You know, it's little things like that, which I think just like lovely little touches. I'm looking forward to episodes 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah, I would add as well, just on what you asked us, Connor, there.
Sure.
Again, the balance, I think, you, without sort of wanting to sound like I'm blowing smoke up, you know, I think the balance is spot on for me. Doesn't feel like a dissertation or anything like that. It feels spot on.
Oh, that's,
and it's a really nice spread of contributors as well. I mean, you've got your John Romero's, you've got your John Carpenter's. That was a bit of a shock seeing him pop up. But then you've got your kind of doctoral thesis writers, and you've got your PhD students, and you've got the guy who wrote Itchy Scratchy, you know, and the Resident Evil history. And it creates a really nice kind of balance, and you know, and you have your emotional moments with certain contributors, but then you have a bit of levity, you know, you have someone talking about what made their game maybe not so good. You know, so from that perspective, you know, it keeps kind of a nice kind of even level of tone. I think, you know, the kind of emotional moments mixed with the humorous moments, and it's incredibly watchable.
Ah, that's glowing feedback, guys. Thank you so much. Cheers.
So, guys, tell the listeners then, just, I know we started at this point, but just once again, just remind the listeners where they can find the doc and how they go about buying it, should they want to.
All right, Connor, you want to take it this time?
Yeah, sure. So, if you head to terabytesdoc.com, that's terra and then bytes.com, you can find the pre-order page there. This is the last chance to get your name in the credits for the thing. It also may be the last chance to get a copy of this thing and see it. There's never any guarantee that this stuff will have, you know, a broad release after the pre-sale campaigns. You know, we hope to high heaven that it'll end up on streaming in some way, shape, or form. But you never know. So if this seems like something that you would be vaguely interested in, bookmark it and wait until the countdown, you know, comes down the wire. And if you're feeling, you know, lucky, take a punt on it, please. You can get it over there. If this seems like the sort of thing you'd like to support, if this seems like the sort of thing that is worth supporting to you, I urge you to do so. I've done the same with In Search of Darkness. I'm not a shill. I'm a fan. What these guys do and what this company does is, I think, worth supporting. Again, I think it's a contribution to the genre and this medium and this thing that we all love. I think that love kind of shines through in the final product as well.
Yeah. Well said, thank you. And just so the listeners are clear, the pre-sale, I think that's what you called it, wasn't it, Richard?
Yes.
The pre-sale that closes midnight on...
This is midnight, like Hawaii time. So we're going to do some conversion there.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah. So I think looking at your countdown timer, which I won't stress you by telling you how long is left. but I think it could. So I think that closes at 11 a.m. on the 14th. So this is UK time. So so British summer time. 11 a.m. on Monday, the 14th of April.
Yeah.
So you've got, from when this goes out, you're going to have 6 or 7 days to get your order in. And as Connor's just said there, no guarantee that it is going to be available once that pre-sale window closes. And who doesn't want the name in the credits, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I was just going to say that time is like your own little Dead Rising countdown, isn't it?
It is too. Oh, man.
No, guys, thank you so much. And this is going to be fascinating for the listeners, I think. I'm sure most people are going to be across this anyway who listen to our podcast because, you know, it's right within most listeners' wheelhouse. And Richard, you did mention it when you talked to us about the footy book last year as well. So good luck is all I would say. You know, the very best of wishes. I hope the sales goes well. We want to see more gaming documentaries from you guys in future. So I wish you every success. Thank you for giving up your time. And Jim, we shall bid our listeners goodbye.
We will. I just want to say thanks again, guys. Yeah, I can't wait to see the final product.
Thanks again for having us, guys. This is hugely vindicating. And this was a pleasure.
Good stuff. Listeners, until next time, keep it retro, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Playing so fast, they're the only ones who can take you back in time. They play old games, they're more retro than J1 Optimus Prime. At home or the arcade for adventures.